I know you've been involved in some human rights, civil liberty type processes.
Oh, yeah.
Extracurricular, maybe.
Extracurricular. Yeah, I mean, I think being a gay man, I mean, I've always, or certainly as an adult, I've been very interested in civil rights issues and also LGBT rights. And I've been involved both as a legislator and as an attorney. We back in the 80s, we still had a statute in Kentucky that criminalized gay conduct, you know. And it was the fourth degree sodomy statute that made it a crime for gay people to have sex, intimacy, you know. So
that was not that long ago.
No,
I mean, you know,
not at all.
Things have changed quite a bit.
Oddly enough, the model penal code, the new criminal statutes in Kentucky, was adopted in the 70s. And we had kind of the model from the country, you know, that we adopted, that we were going to put in place in Kentucky. And it wasn't going to criminalize gay conduct.
Mm-hmm.
But then a legislator from Louisville pushed to criminalize gay conduct. And so it was inserted in what would have been the model penal code. But so it was less than ideal.
Mm-hmm.
And this was done in the late 70s. And so in the 80s, it turned out that I was doing criminal defense work. And Lexington had made an effort to charge a bunch of people for being gay. And they posted undercover cops near the bar, what is now the bar, mm-hmm. on Main Street, behind the bar, and really try to engage in conversation with folks that frequent the bar and see mm-hmm. whether they would, you know, proposition them for gay contact.
Entrapment, is that what they...
Well...
Or bordering on that? Or
Entrapment, and, you know, if you're going to be strictly legal about it, it's when you try to get somebody to do something that they wouldn't do otherwise. In this case, mm-hmm. people were very willing participants. It was just a matter of giving them the opportunity. So it wasn't a true entrapment. But, I mean, it's in the vernacular, I think you're probably... you're right.
Uh-huh.
And so what they would do, they'd have somebody there undercover, and then... they would tape these conversations, you know, and try to get people to invite them home and so forth. And that's what I had a few clients that this was 1986 that were caught, you know, in this. They got like 25 or 30 people all at once, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They got all this investigation, then they arrested them all, you know, charged them all. And
what sort of penalties were they would they
face?
Well,
it would have been up to, at that time, it would have been 90 days. It was an attempt to commit fourth degree sodomy, so it would have been 90 days in jail, possibly,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know.
But a lot of expense and trouble. And
And of course, they were willing to work these things out, you know, a fine, maybe stay away, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I posed to my client, I said, if you want to, you know, because he was saying this isn't fair.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I agree. I said, if you want to, we can challenge it, you know. And so we decided to challenge it. And I put together a team of attorneys to help me, and we went about preparing for this, you know, constitutional challenge to the statute in Kentucky. At first, we were hoping that a U.S. Supreme Court case would solve the problem for us, because there was in the pipeline a case that was going to the U.S. Supreme Court, Hardwick versus, my mind's slipping, the Hardwick case, and
right.
It was out of Georgia.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And
it was a similar situation. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. There they were facing like 20 years in penitentiary.
Uh-huh.
But the Supreme Court let us down. And so in 1986, uh-huh. we couldn't hinge on that. So then we changed strategy and we said, okay, let's argue not U.S. Constitution, let's argue the Kentucky Constitution. And we've got an incredibly rich constitution when it comes to protection of minority groups.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it has got this provision that says, you know, the majority, you know, you even the largest majority, you can exercise absolute and arbitrary power. You know, so no matter how mm-hmm. many folks agree with you, you can't just snuff mm-hmm. out the opposition, you know.
There's another keystone to the American way.
Oh, yeah.
That the minority always has its rightful place and voice, and it can't be suppressed or
yes.
oppressed.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a beautiful phrase in our Constitution, Section 2. It doesn't appear in everybody's Constitution.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So we use that in a bunch of cases, really, that back in the old times when it dealt with alcohol. And where the court said, well, now, if you have alcohol in your home, you know, that's okay. You can't criminalize that.
Right,
or smoking,
right.
You know,
right.
in your own privacy.
Uh-huh.
And so we had a situation where Jeff Wasson was the kid who had invited the officer to come home. And yes, he wanted to have gay sex with the officer, but it was in the privacy of his home. It was an adult asking another adult, not for money, mm-hmm. just volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a perfect fact situation. So that's what we presented to the court. And we had all these experts.
Now, what court did you take this to?
The district judge.
Okay.
It was Louis Paisley who presided uh-huh. as the district judge.
Uh-huh.
And he allowed us to have all this argument with this anthropologist and historians and theologians and everything and sex experts and health experts to say there's no justification mm-hmm. for this criminal statute to, you know, to criminalize this kind of conduct. There's mm-hmm. nothing inherently wrong about it. And, you know, straight people do this stuff. Why can't gay people do this stuff?
Right, right.
And so we argued there was no state interest, basically justification mm-hmm. for the criminal statute.
And so even though you're going into district court, you're prepared to go up. That's the process. You would go up to a court of appeals,
yeah.
then the Kentucky Supreme Court, I assume? Or
right.
You would fight the battle at every level.
Right. So, but you have to create the records. So we had to get
yeah.
all the expert testimony in.
Right.
We did. And we had tremendous support from professionals that came in to help us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we won. The Judge Paisley ruled it was unconstitutional and threw it out. Then the state appealed to the circuit court. And at that time, it was Charlie Tackett. He was a circuit judge.
Mm-hmm.
And he agreed also and said, yeah, this is unconstitutional.
And this all turns on the judge's decision?
Because it's not a jury question.
Okay.
It was a legal argument. So
okay.
the judge makes the legal calls.
Mm-hmm.
And so then after Judge Tackett, then once again, the state was appealing and they wanted to appeal the court of appeals. And we said, well, let's just go on straight to the Supreme Court because ultimately it should go there. So we bypassed the court of appeals, went straight to the Supreme Court. And then sure enough, in a 4-3 decision, the Supreme Court ruled with us. And
mm-hmm.
it was 1992. It took 6 years
wow.
of litigation. But we finally won. And Jeff, bless his heart, the defendant who was willing to fight, lost 2 jobs while this process was going
mm-hmm.
on, whenever there was publicity about the case.
Mm-hmm.
It was really quite an effort on his part. And he was quite brave to
yeah.
be willing to do that. And that was certainly one of the cases that I'm most proud of as an attorney for having
mm-hmm.
done that. I got help from a lot of experts and several attorneys pitched in and part of the legal team, but it was quite a pleasure to be part of that.
And once the Supreme Court finds in your favor, then is there another way that it's undone? Do you have to be vigilant going forward?
Well,
always a slippery slope.
Yeah, good point. Well, first uh-huh. of all, because the decision was based on Kentucky Constitution, they couldn't go up to the U.S. Supreme Court. That was it.
I see.
Because on Kentucky uh-huh. Constitution, Kentucky Supreme Court is the ultimate word. You know,
mm-hmm.
that was the end of the case.
Mm-hmm.
But then what the right wing decided to do is said, well, let's change the Constitution to allow this. So lo and behold, then we found in the legislature, I was already in the legislature, got elected in 84, so I'd
uh-huh.
been there. Then they were trying to say, let's get a constitutional amendment to change things so that we can reinstate a sodomy statute
mm-hmm.
against gays. Unfortunately, that didn't pass.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to beat that down. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Kentucky's actually been fairly progressive in certain ways, hasn't it? I mean, especially when you look at our friends in the Deep South and Texas and...
Yeah, we were the first state after the Supreme Court case in the Hardwick, Bowers versus Hardwick, that's the case.
Uh-huh.
After that one, we were the first state that used state constitutions to grant the right of privacy and right of equal protection to gay people as it related to criminal statutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then 16 years later, the U.S. Supreme Court in the Texas case finally did the right thing and
mm-hmm.
threw out all the remaining criminal statutes. Yeah.
Well, it seems like in that category of human freedoms, in fact, all social freedom. I mean, the country's moving along quite swimmingly, or maybe that's overstating it, as far as social evolution goes, the rights of gay people, the rights of all sorts of minorities.
Oh, we've made tremendous progress in the last 20 years.
Uh-huh. Now, we've seen some slippage.
Oh, yeah.
As you alluded to. But it seems like that the real spirit of America, this country, seems to be one of liberty, that we want to grant people options and choices and freedoms.
Well, I think the more people understand and are educated about minorities, whatever that group may be, it makes a world of difference, you mm-hmm. know. And you can't underestimate the value of all the gay characters on TV and in mm-hmm. theater and the movies and the neighbors that come out to their neighbors or the mm-hmm. you know, in your faith or you're at work, and all of a sudden the gay people aren't these strange, mysterious folks. These are people you know, and they're in your family and mm-hmm. your coworkers, and you know, when you get down to it, we're not any different than anybody else. You know, we're yeah. just as crazy and just as smart or just as stupid as anybody else. And so that people, you know, once they're close up and personal with people like that, then all the, you know, all that prejudice, I think, melts away.
Yeah, it really is linked to ignorance. You have to be insulated from contact with whoever the people are before you can really keep your prejudices closeted yeah. and right. healthy, you
oh,
know.
Yeah. And you see it now with immigrants, you see it with Muslims. I mean, uh-huh. it's the whole thing all over again, you know. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And unfortunately, there's always that segment of the population, for whatever reason, that wants to limit that. You know, they're opposed to that. They feel threatened. And it's always like a solid 15-20% of people that seem to turn out in elections and vote that or express that, you know.
Yeah. Maybe a little higher sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I think we're in a surge, yeah. period. But that's how that, for me, there was a good friend of mine who I'd met in high school. And ironically, he was always dating the prettiest women. But uh-huh. One night, he said to me, he said, you know, you're a good friend of mine. And I guess we were like 19. And he said, I want to tell you something. And he, you know, told me. And he said, I just want to make sure that my friends, you know, stay my friends. And mm-hmm. I could tell he was nervous. And, you know, it was yeah. a big moment for him. This is 1971 or something.
Oh, sure.
And I said, oh, that's cool, man. You know, you know, that's whatever you want to do. Fine. And he was greatly relieved and went on to become one of my closest friends. And that was a turning point. That was good.
Well, I mean, I remember when I came out, which was to myself, it was back in 1978. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know a single gay person. Not a single gay person
wow.
that I could go talk to or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the very first counselor I approached on this was also a good Roman Catholic, and he couldn't handle the issue,
uh-huh.
and he wouldn't.
But you actually went to a professional counselor?
Yeah, a counselor, yeah. Uh-huh. I thought, you know, let's talk about this, uh-huh. you know. And the counselor was clearly uncomfortable dealing with this.
I think people forget how under the rug it was, you know, that
yeah.
it was just a no-say.
Well, it was just in the early 70s that the American Psychological Association, American Psychiatric Association, first said formally, uh-huh. this is not a disease.
Uh-huh. It's not a psychological problem.
Yeah, that's yeah. right. Uh-huh. So, you know, then I was able, then actually it was my straight friends that said, why don't you go find somebody, a counselor that, you know, is uh-huh. comfortable with this issue. And I did, and mm-hmm. it was changed everything, you know. But no, I mean, not having any role models, you know, not mm-hmm. having any gay friends, I mean, this was a challenge,
mm-hmm.
you know. All of a sudden, how could you integrate what you thought you were going to be or wanted to be with being a gay person?
Mm-hmm.
In the 70s, it was not easy. It was yeah. not easy. So, no, and I think your response to your friend was wonderful and great. And but it that would not have been uniform. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of people would have felt very uncomfortable, would have wanted to distance themselves
uh-huh.
from your friend, probably. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, my mother had been active in theater, so I had met a lot of
gay people,
fellow travelers, that. As you were, you know, and they were just sweet, good people. And, you know, so even as a young lad, I realized, well, there's not, you know, they were funny and talented. And, you know, I mean, it was just a natural flow. But the world has changed quite a bit in recent time, in our lifetime,
yes.
for sure.
Yes.
And I think people, young people particularly, that I don't think they're aware of how it was. Yeah.
Well, and it's really interesting about how some people would be comfortable with knowing a gay person as long as it wasn't talked about or mm-hmm. it wasn't out there. You know,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, I saw it in the legislature. You know, most everybody knew I was gay, but it wasn't talked about officially mm-hmm. and formally. And
mm-hmm.
finally, I thought I was going to make a public statement about it because I thought it was my contribution. You know, I mean, here I am in the legislature and in a position of power, you know, limited, but still position mm-hmm. of political power. And I felt there was my obligation to be out there publicly to say, hey, you know, I'm gay. I'm just like everybody else.
That's a very brave step to have.
Well, I'm sure some people would have wished I'd done it earlier, you know.
But that's early on. I mean, in the story we're telling here, that's early. Especially to be a politician, I think, which is kind of doubly complex. Then your job depends on elections.
Popularity.
And, yeah, popularity. The popular vote. Anyway, I applaud that. I mean, even this many years later.
Well, thank you. I didn't know exactly how it was going to happen. And they had an opportunity to run against me. I announced or made a comment about it a year before I was running for re-election. So if somebody was going to run against me, they certainly could have, mm-hmm. but they didn't.
How did you make that comment? Just in the media?
Well, actually, I was asked to speak to a human resource convention, resource people convention from all over the state, because I'd worked on the provision about the non-discrimination for LGBT state workers.
Uh-huh.
They wanted me to talk about the executive order, which I'd worked on, and I was glad to do it. And I said, you know, this is probably a good way. And all along, I'd always said, you know, it's really not an issue, somebody's sexual orientation, it's not a big deal. And so I didn't want to bring it up as a big deal by doing a press conference
right,
or anything.
Right.
I thought I would just mention it in mm-hmm. the context of that presentation. And I said, look, I personally haven't, even though I'm a gay man, I didn't suffer employment discrimination. But there's a bunch of people in state government that do.
Mm-hmm.
They complain about it and so forth. We need that protection, and that's why I worked on this executive order.
Mm-hmm.
So I said it in that context.
Mm-hmm.
And, the reaction was positive. Certainly in my district, it was positive. I didn't, there was a few hate mails and mm-hmm. so forth.
And what was your district, the 75th?
75th was the House, and then the 13th was the Senate.
Uh-huh.
And it included most of downtown.
Uh-huh.
So it was a pretty good, progressive, district. It still remains that way.
Yes. Yeah.
But it was interesting that some of the legislators felt uncomfortable, even though, they knew I was gay.
Mm-hmm.
But now that it was out in the open, mm-hmm. it was like a little...
The rule was you could be it, you just couldn't say
it.
Yeah.
And somebody specifically asked to not sit next to me, thinking that that would somehow be interpreted.
Uh-huh.
But that's all right. It takes all kinds. And mm-hmm. It eventually got to the point where we could talk about it, and I think other legislators felt a little more comfortable talking about it. And so it took about a year
mm-hmm.
that I think that in the caucus I was making jokes about it and people were actually laughing and,
uh-huh.
and not,
And then Will and Grace came along. I think Will and Grace probably did more. Certainly for older people.
Yes.
When it just became so.
Yeah.
And luckily that show was so good, so well written.
Ellen,
uh-huh.
remember?
Yeah.
And Will and
uh-huh.
Grace. And
uh-huh.
then
Ellen, yeah.
There were several other shows and movies. Yeah. No.
Uh-huh. It's a popular culture. What rides on popular culture?
Yes.
How it rises and falls.
Yes.
And the law seems to be behind that. I mean, to follow along afterward. After society reckons with change, then the laws are changed.
Yeah, sometimes leaders aren't real leaders.
Mm-hmm.
We're followers,
They're quick to follow.
Yeah.
And quick to take credit.
Yeah.
But
that's okay.
Yeah.
As long as we're making progress, sometimes
uh-huh.
The leaders will actually be leaders. Sometimes they'll be followers. That's
mm-hmm.
okay, but... That's part of it.
Mm-hmm. It is a stride like that, I think, that moving ahead in many dimensions,
mm-hmm.
and that's how true change that doesn't revert, occurs.
And quite frankly, I think sometimes in leadership, you got to be careful that you don't get too far ahead of the crowd.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you do, then they won't follow.
Uh-huh.
So it's a tough game to figure out how far can you go to actually lead people
uh-huh.
without losing them.
Without scaring them
yeah.
with too much, too soon.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's like surfing. So what about the national political scene? Do you want to talk about that for a minute?
Well, the problem is, as a judge, I really can't.
Oh, can you not?
Can't,
okay.
I can't give partisan comments or anything like that, indicating support or whatever for individual candidates. I can't do that. I can talk about general comments and scenes and culture. And that
I was just going to speak in general, just the times in which we live, without naming names, perhaps, that we're, I don't know, in my own heart of hearts, I feel like so many reasons to be optimistic and then kind of reasons to be less than optimistic. It just seems like we're living in curious times where we are pivoting, like with the Sanders campaign, where he wants to do something that's truly, truly progressive, and then this whole other sort of resistive power that wants to go backwards. And I guess that's always the dynamic, but it seems these days, these months, that it's really come to the surface, and that's very visible. You can just feel that's tangible now to even the casual observer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, the commentary that about the, you know, across the board, you know, that you have a resentment towards the rich. I mean, you know, that's across the line, party lines, and
that's kind of a new thing. That's something that wasn't talked about. You know, the 1% idea didn't evolve until, what was it called? Occupy Wall Street.
Right.
But it's funny how a word has to come out, a concept has to come out. It has to be ingested by the society in a way, or by the majority of the people in the society. Mm-hmm. And then once the vocabulary is put in place, then it can be used to describe the reality, and then movement. We can progress from there, if progress is what we want to do. In the progressive
well,
sense.
I mean, but it's true. I mean, you've had this enormous, you know, this concentration of wealth in a small number of
folks. Phenomenally. I mean,
this is a statement of fact, and so the response really is not that surprising.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's great if you've got a all this wealth, and then but other people sharing the wealth, but when you've got such a concentration in a small number of people, it's expected, I think, that people are going to resent that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they've shown it across the board, and how the system responds to that is going to be quite interesting.
That every aspect of the political offerings, I mean, what the parties are offering, are responding to that inequality.
Yeah, I think so.
Income inequality. Yeah. It seems to be a through thread. Both sides, each in their own way.
And, you know, nobody likes to feel powerless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can't control your life, if you can't make a decent living for your family, you know, I mean, that's the ultimate powerlessness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you can't afford to get the food, the medicine, you know, and that's a primal kind of need.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think the things are stacked against you and, you know, you respond, you react, you know, and that's, but now the test is, how is our system going to respond to that?
Mm-hmm.
Do we ignore it? Do we fight back, or do we make concessions and realize that maybe we ought to do things a little better to make the system fair for everybody, economically fair.
Yeah. And economics is the underlying, you know, you can talk about fairness in the abstract or in a social dimension, but, you know, like you say, if you cannot bring home the bacon, that just undercuts every aspect of empowerment for individuals.
Well, let me mention the one thing that I'm really proud of being involved with here in the last 10 years, and that's, it's an extracurriculum activity, if you will.
Uh-huh.
But this is also dealing with the LGBT community. Because I'd been involved in the past in kind of crisis fundraising for LGBT issues. And, of course, we had to do fundraising for the Wasson case, even though the attorneys, we all contributed our time, and most of the experts did it for free. We still had lots of expenses involved in litigation, had to raise money for that. But throughout the years, been involved with crisis fundraising. And then we thought, let's see if we can come up with a way to create an endowment. Mm-hmm. That we would have a kind of perpetual revenue stream, if you will, for LGBT efforts around the state to try to educate people, to try to break down the discrimination and the barriers.
So the money would be there when the situation arose. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So we went about that and enlisted the help of Deborah Hensley. And
uh-huh.
So we teamed up and we said, okay, how do we do this? Let's try to get somebody to on board. It'll, you know, give us a good match and try to kick it off. And our goal was we were going to raise $1 million. So we were able to get Cliff Todd, a gentleman out of Louisville, to make a $500,000 match. Said, you raise next 4 years, you raise $500,000, I'll give you $500,000. sure enough, we raised the $500,000. He gave us the $500,000. Wow. So in 2011, we set up this $1 million endowment.
Uh-huh.
We've continued to raise money, and we're now up to 1.3. But what we've done since 2011, we started using our earnings every year to fund education efforts around the state.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a variety of things.
And I what's the name of the program?
Just Fund Kentucky.
Just Fund Kentucky.
J-U-S-T-F-U-N-D, Just Fund Kentucky.
Uh-huh.
And we've given grants to theater groups that have done plays about LGBT discrimination, gay bashing in the 50s, for example, Pandora Productions in Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
We've helped with bullying campaigns in the public schools, I mean, to teach how to deal with bullying. We've dealt with the medical education, both at U of L and UK, to try to train healthcare professionals how to deal with the LGBT population. We've done a writing contest through the Carnegie Center, writing competitions on LGBT issues. We've done training for young people on how to be more be advocates on mm-hmm. issues, LGBT issues. A whole variety of issues throughout this Commonwealth we funded and we're continuing to fund every year. And to me, that this is something that's going to be here forever and ever. You know, it's a revenue stream. It's always going to be here. And education is the key. And if we can keep educating people in Kentucky about these issues, I think we're going to keep breaking down the barriers and trying to promote fair and equal treatment for gays and lesbians and bisexual and transgender.
And as you say, education is the key. That's what lights the light.
Yes.
Well, let me just sum up here and tell our audience once again who I'm speaking to is Judge Ernesto Scorsone, and he is the circuit judge here. And that's a really statewide job, isn't it? It's not a Fayette County job.
No, it is a Fayette County.
Oh, is it? Yeah. Okay.
I'm one of five. Uh-huh. Fayette County judges that do civil and criminal cases. Mm-hmm.
See, the court system confuses me, too. The state government and the court system. Yeah. We'll have to have you back to explain those more in depth. But my guest has been Ernesto Scorsone, and I appreciate his company and his insight very much this evening. And again, this is WLXU-FM Lexington, Kentucky. This show is called Voice Box, and good evening, good night, and thank you very much.